episode 5. Welcome to episode 5 of the Thinking Habits podcast. I'm going to start with a bit of admin before we get into it, just to let you know that I've submitted the podcast to a few more different podcast aggregators, so Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, a couple of others. They're going through their mandatory approval process at the moment, so it should be a day or two before they start appearing, but there should be a problem there. I've also registered, I think I mentioned this in an earlier episode, but I've also registered for a website called coffee.com, ko-fi.com. It's a kind of support website which allows you to, if you like what I'm doing and you like the podcast, to support the podcast without, you know, having to listen to adverts or subscribe to any kind of service. It's just basically, if you like it, buy me a brew. That's the idea, is that you buy content providers a coffee. Helps me to cover the costs of putting this out and the editing and all the stuff that goes into it, because as I keep saying, I'm new to all this, and this is all a big learning experience for me, and it's been a very, very steep learning curve. So any support that you can throw our way is always much appreciated. But with that out of the way, I think it's important to really get into this episode as soon as possible. Before I play the interview, massive content warnings with this. This is a very, very emotionally charged and powerful episode. The content warnings for this episode include rape, sexual violence, HIV, post-traumatic stress, LGBTIAQ plus issues. It starts very, very quickly. There's not a lot of lead up into it. I was incredibly fortunate that a friend of ours, David, contacted me when I first said I was going to do a podcast about mental health, and said that he had a story to tell. So we discussed briefly what that story was, and beyond that, it's entirely, there's no scripting. This is me and him sat with a bottle of wine, and David just spoke, and he spoke eloquently, and he spoke from the heart, and it was an inspiring and quite humbling experience to be trusted with this kind of story and the kind of experiences that David is sharing. I'm not going to lie, it put me a little bit out of my depth at points. You know, even as a mental health nurse, I've heard stories and experiences similar to this in the past, but not for a while, and not from somebody close to me. So I'm hoping that I was able to treat that with the sensitivity it deserves. David seems happy with the content, and I hope that that it's useful to people to hear this story, because I really believe, as David does, that it's something that should be heard. So without any further ado, this is David's story.
Yeah, I'm notoriously quiet, so...
No, I tend to either speak too close or too far away.
So. Right, okay. Well,
David, thank you for coming. So let's not kind of beat about the bush, but... I'll leave the floor open to you. Tell your story, mate. Okay. Go for it.
So, I guess the first thing to state is that I had an experience a good few years ago now where I was raped by someone that I wasn't seeing, but I'd like seen him a few times before. Mm. Obviously, didn't know who was going to rape me because I wouldn't have gone. But it was just quite a weird situation, because I got into a... Like, we got to his house, he'd bought some beer on the way, but then he drank way more than I drank.
Right.
I didn't drive at the time, so I couldn't go home, and he was too drunk to drive me back, and then it just kind of escalated. I won't go into specifics, because I didn't want to, like, it was not very nice, but he raped me, and... then didn't drive me home because he couldn't, and I didn't have any money because I'd left my wallet at home, so I just had to stay in the house. So that was fun for the night. And then he drove me home the next morning, but I was kind of, I didn't see him obviously again ever, but it was just quite a horrible situation to find myself in. And then about a year later, because I didn't go and get myself checked, I didn't go and do any of that stuff, because you're just too scared to do it, or too, I was quite embarrassed really, so I didn't do any of that. And then some time later, I was chatting to a friend of mine who also had done, like, he'd got into like a threesome or something with this guy, and we were talking about it, and I was like, oh, you know, and mentioned his name, and was like, oh, it's, you know, is it that guy? And he said, oh yes, it's him. And I said, well, I should tell you that he's like, he's raped me, kind of thing, a while ago. Then my friend was like, oh, did you know that he has HIV? So I was like, Holy shit. So then I went and got tested, got tested positive for HIV, did all the stuff. Then about a year later, and I'd had like various panic attacks about what happened. I'd kind of had a bit of time off work, not like majorly, but just like I'd gone in and been like, I can't do this, and gone out and what have you, and kept having panic attacks about it. But the one that kind of really got me was, I was in the Arndale on like a random Saturday, came out of like one of the, I think, Top Man somewhere, and he was like right there, he was just like stood, I don't know if he saw me or not, but I saw him, and got from Primark, sorry, no, got from Topshop in the Arndale to Primark. I have no idea how I got there. I like blacked out completely, woke up, like came to, and had like stuff, I think I'd spilled coffee all over my shoes or something, but I just like had no recollection of anything from like the last 5 minutes.
So almost like a complete sort of fight or flight.
So that happened, and I've had like various panic attacks since, but I've learned to, because I went to therapy, like work organised therapy for me afterwards, because I was like coming into work and like bursting into tears and all this kind of stuff. So they'd organised therapy for me after it, and that was helpful. It was good to kind of like talk about it, and I got a lot of good ways of dealing with it afterwards and all this kind of stuff, so that was really good. But that's kind of the story, I guess. And I don't know, because I was always like, oh, I wonder what I'd do if I ever saw him again, and that's obviously what I would do.
Wow, blimey.
So
work were able to facilitate you getting some support.
My work's really good, because they have a and they've got a mental health protection team essentially, so they'll always help you with stuff like that. So that's
quite
good
rare
to do.
And
they give you, like, I got, I think, 5 or 6 free sessions, and then if you want to carry on, you have to pay for it, kind of thing. But it's good to do. It's a really good service that they offer, and I know a couple of people who've used it.
Yeah,
as well. So yeah,
talking in the interview I did yesterday for the work related stress one, more and more businesses are being more kind of conscious of mental health and how the workforce is affected. But it's still so sadly lacking. But even then, that I can't even imagine that kind of level of trauma to have to be able to deal with that. It must be.
I mean, it's difficult to do. It's because it kind of affected my relationships afterwards a little bit as well, because I didn't want to tell anyone about it, and then trying to like be intimate with other people was a bit difficult, because you're worried about that happening again. And it hasn't ever happened again, but it's something that's always being in the back of my mind, like, oh, if I become vulnerable with this person, then they could take advantage of it, that kind of thing. So unfortunately, I mean, I'm married now, so it's not really a thing anymore, but it's just something that when I first got with my husband, I had to tell him about it, because I was just like, I can't, if we're gonna do this long term, I have to tell you this information. And he was really supportive. I was worried about, because I rang a friend of mine and I was like, I'm worried that he's going to leave me and all this kind of stuff, because, you know, I didn't want to tell him, but he was really, really supportive. And that's helped a lot. I know, you know, a lot of people who similar things have happened to, and they've not had that support network around them. So it's been quite kind of refreshing, I suppose, to have that.
I'm going to come across, I mean, I'm going to put my hand up and say you plead complete ignorance, but what is there? Do you feel that there's a stigma? I mean, I've spoken to and worked with people who've been victims of sexual abuse, rape, trauma. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that there is an ongoing stigma against male rape?
Yeah,
because that's something that I've seen. I mean, there's ongoing stigmas against sexual assault in all its forms, and everything needs just pulling up from the ground up. But certainly the experiences that I can speak of, obviously used to work in a prison. It was a male prison, so obviously my first hand experience is obviously with male rape survivors. Do you think that there needs to be more support?
I think there does need to be more. I think it's becoming more spoken about. It's becoming a bit less stigmatised, but still not as much as it was. I mean, you've got great things, specifically in Manchester, there's a organisation called Survivors, which is literally about
Duncan.
That. So, yes.
Duncan from the Survivors Network. Yeah. I met him, he's a lovely guy. Amazing work he does.
And they're really, really great. And I've contacted them a couple of times. I didn't do any therapy stuff with them, but I did contact them just to kind of say, like, this has happened to me, and they gave me some really good resources and links and stuff, so that's really, really good. What else was I going to say? In terms of, I think, general public awareness, I mean, obviously you must be aware of the kind of recent-ish Coronation Street storyline, I think.
Yes.
Of, like, rape and then suicide, like that whole thing. I think that's kind of really brought it to light a bit more, that this isn't something that just kind of you can't talk about anymore. You have to get
in the media. I don't remember anything other than that. I mean, it's a left field reference, but years ago, do you remember there was a Hollyoaks storyline?
Yeah,
with Luke, somebody or other, his name was, wasn't it? There was that one, and it was one of those Hollyoaks After Dark ones, and then. But that made the headlines quite, because I think that was like the first real pub media portrayal. I remember that. But I was following the Coronation Street storyline from a mental health perspective as well, because obviously there's the suicide kind of chimed with a couple of high profile media ones.
Well, of course, because I mean it's the same week as the Frightened Rabbit debacle and all of that stuff happened, so that was a bit of a tense week.
How do you think there's any other positive media role models around rape survival and abuse survival at the moment? Is there anything that you can identify?
I mean, it's difficult for, not so much for rape survival, because that's still very much not spoken about. I think the one thing that I would say for suicide survival or suicide attempt survival is Gareth Thomas, who is a rugby player, ex-rugby player, who came out as gay about 5 years ago. But he had previously been married and had children. And one day found himself at the edge of a cliff and was like, I was going to jump and didn't. But he had to really kind of rein himself in and get help. And he's become such a huge role model for young gay people in that situation. People like Keegan Hurst as well, who's another person that's recently come out, and there's a lot of that kind of thing. I think there is this profile around young LGBT people, because there's this like 40% more likely to attempt and or commit suicide, all of this kind of stuff, and I think that doesn't help if you've been involved in a situation like I was, that you don't feel comfortable talking about. That weighs so much on you.
It's almost like a combination of compounding factors. If you're in a marginalised community and you suffer a trauma which, through no fault of your own, is also marginalised in terms of understanding, support, and then you combine those two together, it must be incredibly isolating. It must be. Oh God, I can't even imagine. But do you find the LGBT community in Manchester has been supportive? Because I know a lot of other people in the LGBT community who have different things to say about the UK, globally, Manchester, you know, they have their own opinions about what's good and what's bad about the community. Again, I can't really comment personally, but
I think for the community as a whole, we're generally doing all right, to be honest. I think we're one of the more kind of generally accepting. I can't remember who said it, but there's a quote where it was after the Pulse
nightclub shoot in the Florida one
a couple of years ago, and someone said like it's an invasion of space, because they felt that in the Orlando gay scene they could go into any bar and you're instantly accepted and you're instantly made to feel welcome, and that's something that the Manchester scene, for me, the Manchester kind of gay quarter has shown that you are welcome and you are accepted. I think there are certain areas or certain bars or certain places that you go to that you're expected to be a certain kind of person if you go in there, and that's not necessarily always gonna quite correlate with who you are, kind of thing. But generally speaking, I think we're probably one of the better communities in the country for that kind of support.
Why do you think that is? Do you think that's just because of the kind of, I mean, I've only lived in Manchester for 12 years, but there's certainly a very kind of inclusive spirit.
I've lived here for half that time. So.
Really?
I mean, No, 2009. So, yeah, so 9 years. I think there kind of has to be, when you're in a city like this one, or like London, or like Bristol, that is so, not Bristol, Brighton, sorry, that's so diverse and so multicultural, you have to be ready to be inclusive of everyone, and you can't be this person that shuts yourself off and makes yourself unavailable to other people, because they'll crop up again and again and again in your life, and you need to get into it.
Growing up in Harrogate,
so, and Chester as well for me.
As much as it likes to think itself as being, you know, multicultural and open to everything, it's very parochial under the surface. If you dig deeper, well, you don't even have to dig that deep.
I went to like Chester's only, well, not only gay bar, but like one of Chester's gay bars when I was sort of very, very newly out. And even the bouncers were like generally offensive to like gay people. And I was like, God, this isn't really the thing,
that's
is
not,
it? Like,
that's not what you want to see. So as far as managing those that panic, did you find that the work therapy helped, or was it outside interests, and or was it a combination?
Kind of a combination of lots of things. Yeah, I mean the work therapy did help a lot, just in terms of talking to someone. Like, it was really good to just be able to talk to someone and know that it wasn't going to go anywhere. But I think also I found that kind of just controlling how I thought about it was another way, because I had got to a point where I would just be overwhelmed by the memory of it and all this kind of stuff, and so I had to channel that in a lot of different ways, and I learned to kind of compartmentalize it. I mean, I still think about it every day. I still think about him every day. I still wander around town looking for him, because that's just what you do. But it's compartmentalized now, and I've done that in a number of ways. The first is just kind of talking. The second was being able to think, okay, that's done now, let's concentrate on what's happening now. But the third was writing, and I wrote a blog for a while, which was just me writing letters to him, because that was one of the things that my therapist was like, write a letter to him, and I did, and I wrote another one, and then wrote another one, and I hadn't realised, but I had so much to say about this one incident. But that was also really helpful, because it helped me to kind of look at it from a lot of different angles. I mean, I'd been thinking about it from the perspective of me in that room, in that position, in that situation, having no control, not really able to move, because he was bigger than I was, and much heavier. he was a bouncer himself, actually. So I was like, oh, because I'm very small.
Yeah.
So I couldn't really move or leave the room. So I kind of was able, through writing about it and thinking about the different things going through my head at the time, was able to come away from just being that person kind of pinned to the bed and being a person thinking about what I'd say to him if I hadn't been in that position, or if I'd just been a person looking at the scene.
Yeah.
So that was really good to do in that respect, because it helped me to kind of think about it in a more abstract way. So I wasn't then, every time I thought about it, just going under kind of thing.
Right. So it sounds like a kind of reclamation of the power in that dynamic. Yeah. Wow.
So I wrote a blog. I'd created a drag character, which I haven't done anything with.
Really?
Just put, like, all off the back of it. Mm. So in the same way that, like, Jonathan Davis from Korn writes all of his albums about his dad abusing him as a kid, I had kind of done the same thing. I created a drag character called Elvira Lode, which is an HIV reference.
That's very clever.
And I've written a number of pieces. I've not performed anything, but I've written a number of pieces in her voice about it, and a number of pieces about, you know. So I've done, like, I came up with this pub quiz concept called Get Tested with Elvira Lode, and all this kind of, like, stuff, so that I could be more positive about it and try and not have it be the be all and end all of my life, I suppose. Because I think that's the problem with something like that that's so traumatic. Once you let it take you over, that's it.
Yeah.
And that's how you get into long-term therapy, and it's how you get into long-term depression, all that kind of stuff. Like, I have a friend who didn't leave the house for 6 months because she just couldn't do anything. She was so swamped by depression. Oh, she just didn't leave the house. So she left, you know, lost a job, all this stuff, and then didn't want to get another one because she couldn't, like, force herself to leave the house, you know. So
the fear of the cycle repeating itself.
Absolutely.
God. Yeah, it's I mean, that's absolutely incredible. I mean, again, it's as a mental health nurse, you know, you have a lot of empathy for a lot of traumatic experiences and things that people tell you, but at the end of the day, what you've got to remember is that in a large number of circumstances, you can't imagine for a second being in that situation. I mean, human beings have empathy, but fucking hell, I mean that's hardcore. So what do you think needs to change support wise that's available now? What do you think there needs to be more of?
I'd like to see more. I mean, there's, you know, there's dropping clinics and there's all that kind of stuff, which is just kind of par for the course, I think.
Yeah.
I'd like to see more groups like Survivors. I really, really would. I think they do brilliant work.
They're criminally underfunded as
absolutely,
well.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I'd like to see more groups like that, but just more conversations happening. Like, people don't talk about this stuff, and I think that's what was so impressive about the Coronation Street debacle, if that's the right word.
Yeah.
It got people talking about it. Yes, anyone talking about it for a couple of weeks, but it got them talking about it, and I think that's something that's really important, because people don't talk about this stuff, and if you're a man, gay, straight, or whatever you want to call yourself, you're not supposed to have emotion, you're not supposed to show emotion, you're not supposed to be emotional, and to have something like that happen to you, you need to get it out, whether you're meant to be emotionally available or not. And if there's no platform to do it, whether it's Twitter, whether it's a hashtag, whether it's whatever, if there isn't that platform, then you keep building it up and storing it inside yourself, and then all of a sudden you become the vocalist from Frightened Rabbit, and it's just like spirals.
Yeah.
So.
And it's I mean, I've noticed, I can't remember what the name of the actual campaign is. I'll put it in at the end, but it's like those posters you see on bus shelters, like Manuary, and it's a slogan underneath, like the feeling like you have to keep up with your mates, drink for drink, and all that stuff. And you know, I think it's the campaign against living miserably, but it might,
yes, it is.
Is
yes,
it?
I
is
think
it?
So.
It
yes,
that. But that's brilliant. I mean, just getting it out. Comedians like John Robbins, who talks really openly about his, he calls it the darkness, but he talks openly about his depression on a mid-afternoon Saturday radio station, and he's getting a lot of plaudits, and rightly so, for being open about that. But I don't remember a time prior to in the last sort of 18 months where I was ever encouraged to talk about anything. I was talking about this today, working in the prison, you just had to just fucking shut down completely. Yeah. It's
there's the guy from Peep Show as well, Robert Webb.
Yeah, he's written a book, hasn't he?
Biography, which I cannot remember the name of.
How Not to Be a Boy. That's right. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
About that. And I haven't read the whole thing, but I've read bits of it, and it's brilliant. It's
I saw his interview about his kids. He did a little. It was a short interview about his kids and how there was an absolute expectation on certain gender roles and how he found that absolutely baffling that boys and then obviously men just don't have the opportunity to articulate their feelings.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, actually, there was a I think it was on Instagram today. There was a person I follow. Again, I'm going to have to put this in at the end. But the person I follow was saying that she doesn't normally wear nail varnish, but she was. She went to have a haircut, and somebody said, "Oh, you don't normally wear nail varnish, do you?" And it started off this huge rant about, as she called it, huge rant about the fact that women are allowed to be called tomboys or, you know, badasses for being more masculine, but if boys act more feminine, they're squashed down for it. I certainly witnessed that. I've been in working in an environment where it's all alpha male. You know, every single person who walks through the door in a prison is an alpha male. So even if they're not, they have to pretend to be. So I spent 5 years watching people who clearly weren't trying to be and just falling apart because it wasn't who they were. And it's heartbreaking.
It's exhausting, really. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's but. How do you change that? The whole culture is, I mean, other than, you know, smashing the patriarchy.
Yeah. But that's it. And it's I think it's a societal problem as much as anything else, because you don't have, and this is going to sound horrible, but you don't have this expectation as a man that you're allowed to go to pieces where, that's more accepted if you're female, or if you identify as female, you're more able to do that in that respect. I know that sounds awful, sorry,
but I catch myself when I say that as well. I do because it does sound awful, but the evidence is clear that is the case. There is evidence to suggest that the reason why male suicide or people who identify as male suicide is higher is because they don't feel that they can talk about it.
Yeah.
And the reading some stats yesterday about work-related stress, that it's far greater in the female population. Well, it's not far greater. It's sort of 65-35 more sort of women who will seek help or identify as having a work-related stress problem, whereas it's knuckle down. And the evidence from, and there was a GP study over tens of thousands of anonymized patients bears that out, and that what some of the reasons given were, I'm not allowed to talk about it. I can't. The industry I'm in doesn't suffer that kind of behaviour. And you just think, fuck. Well, how is it ever going to get any better?
Yeah.
If we can't accept the fact that people are going to get ill, people are going to suffer trauma, people are going to be struggling from time to time. I mean, as a mental health nurse, I was off for 4 months with stress and depression, and the support I got while I was off sick was admittedly very good from occupational health. But when I went back to work, the support I got from inside the prison was fucking dreadful.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't often correlate
No.
You know, whereas your company sounds amazing. Because they've taken a step back and said, what do we need to do to help our staff? And Anne yesterday, she said the same thing. What do we need to do to make sure that our workforce is happy and ultimately productive?
Yeah.
But at the same time, it doesn't have to be couched like that.
No, and I think that's something to really think about, because I saw something a while ago on one of the many social medias that was just a sentence, and it was just like, why are you killing yourself for a job that would replace you in like within a week if you weren't there? And it's like, well, it's true. Don't do it. And I think while it's funny, there's an underlying thing that it's really not, and you need to look after yourself first. If you can't do that, then where's it going to do it? Like, you need to do it.
The one that always, and I can't remember, I'm always trying to remember who said it to me. It was somebody at work who said it to me. He said, you should always work to live, you should never live to work. Because if you're living to work, then you're not living your life.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I've always tried to, but I think by virtue of the way that job stress jumps onto your life, or other things jump onto your life, sometimes when you lose focus on that kind of thing, on what's important, other things take on importance, because you start struggling to find, you start struggling to identify what it is that's important in your life, and then the things that aren't really important when it comes down to it become important. So you feel like you are still doing the right thing until all of a sudden you go, actually, what the fuck am I doing? I'm working 14-hour days, or my lifestyle's changed, or it's become more chaotic, or I'm doing X, Y, and Z. And it's so common in depression and anxiety and things like bipolar disorder as well. You have the manic and the depressive phase. So
I mean, I don't, you know, like, I'm getting into like looking for another job at the moment, and at the moment I'm willing to take a pay cut, because I get 2 days off together every so often, but not all the time. And I've been working weekends since about 2011, and I'm over it. I need to have time, because my husband only works the Monday to Friday slot, so he's always got the weekend.
Yeah.
It's really difficult to juggle if we're going away for the weekend.
Yeah,
I've got to take holiday to do that, and it's a nightmare, because then when we try to go on holiday, it's like, well, I can't do that, because, you know. So there's that to consider. Yeah. I think it's just the work-life balance side of it. I mean, we're kind of getting off.
It all ties in, because it's all... And I think that's the point. I think the point is, it doesn't have to be about a diagnosis or a trauma or anything like that. But everything contributes to your mental health, your mental well-being. If the balance isn't right, then the balance isn't right.
Yeah.
And it's going to cause problems, isn't it?
Of course.
So, I don't know if you can identify with this. I imagine you can. But if my balance is off in those kind of things for too long, that's when I take my eye off the ball with my own mental health, and that's when I start seeing a repetition of relapse signatures, for example. Yeah. So
about a month or so, I was training a team. Part of my job is to like train new teams into the business, and I'd got really into this team. They were like really good. They knew what they were doing. It was really, really great. But one of the days when I was supervising them, there was only me on the floor. They were all having a meltdown because they're new, and I was having a panic attack in the middle of work, but still having to supervise them. And it was like trying to correlate that, like, I can't show that I'm having it because there's no one else to take over. So it was a bit of a nightmare to do that, but at the same time it was kind of quite freeing in a way, because I was able to kind of think about, okay, I've had this therapy, let's bring some of what I learned from that, let's bring some of what I've learned from what I've written, and kind of bring it down. So it was good in a way, to because I had them to focus on, so it was like, let's focus on this stuff that's happening, and it really reined in.
Was it work that caused the panic attack, or was it
I'd been thinking about what happened to me,
right?
and work.
So it's almost, I mean, because what you've described so far sounds a lot like PTSD.
Yeah, so Alaska, I think that's what I have. So probably. I mean, I've not been told that that's what I have, but I would imagine. So, yeah.
One of the things that we talked about when I was working with patients in the prison, I always talk about in the prison, but that was my only frontline nursing experience. But if I have a traumatic event that causes a panic response, and I take however long it takes for me to get past that, and I learn how to deal with that panic response trigger to that traumatic event. If I then experience another traumatic event that triggers a panic response, I will immediately go back to that original traumatic event. So I could walk out in front of a car and it slams its brakes on, all of a sudden, surge of adrenaline, I'm right back where I was at the original thing.
Yeah.
And that's the most insidious thing about PTSD and anxiety and panic, isn't it? Because you can make all this progress, and then something completely innocuous will put you right back at the beginning. But it's not for lack of the work you've done. It's just the way your brain is throwing chemicals up, and it's trying to make sense of what's happening, isn't it?
No, that's it. And after it happened, like, there was a week's phase where I would turn the corner, see my workplace, and burst into tears because he drove me to work. It really freaked me out.
Everything you see, everything you hear,
it was totally the same, and it just really, really got to me. But I think seeing him that time was helpful, because even though it completely floored me, and obviously I blacked out for however long, I don't even know, it could have been 2 minutes or 15, I don't know. But it was helpful because I was like, I'm not doing that again. I'm not getting to that point again. Yeah. Like, I mean, it totally blindsided me because I didn't expect to see him.
Yeah.
But now it's made me more vigilant because I'd forgotten about him. Do you know what I mean? I've just been like, okay, no, I'm not going to think about that. I'm not going to think about him anymore.
Mm.
And because I wasn't thinking about it, because I didn't have a guard up in that respect, that I think that's why it blindsided me so much.
Whereas now you've got almost like a defensive mechanism to be able to prepare yourself for that.
Absolutely,
the next time.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's not that I wouldn't like freak if I saw
I can imagine.
You know, I think I've got that. It's a toolkit, isn't it? And you've got it to use, and that's it.
And I think that, again, going back to Duncan at the Survivors Network, that's a lot of what he talks about is owning it and using it to empower yourself. And, however long and however arduous and however traumatic that it can be in itself, it then becomes something that you can use for your own well-being, isn't it? And that's an incredibly powerful thing. I think we should end there.
Right.
If you're happy to end there.
Yeah, that's fine.
Thank you so much. I feel incredibly, genuinely humbled and privileged that you were. We were talking about this before we did the podcast, that you wanted to talk about this particular subject, and the fact that you felt that you could do that is really touching to me, and I thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I'd hope that you'd come on again, maybe have another chat.
Yeah,
nice one.
That'd be good. Thanks.
Cheers. Thank you.
So that was David's story. Not a lot more I can say to that. It was an absolute privilege to be trusted with such powerful and difficult information to share, and I just have nothing but the utmost respect for David for having the courage and the strength to talk so openly about it. David, as part of his recovery and his journey towards recovery, has a website where he has written letters to his rapist. Now, this is a site that I will share on the podcast link for you to read if you so desire. Again, very powerful, very stark strong language themes. I mean, I'm sure you can imagine that it doesn't pull any punches. So obviously be careful if that's something that could cause you any distress. But it is a powerful read, but I would say it's also a necessary read. As far as research around this topic, from my experience of working with people in forensic services who have been the victim of rape and sexual assault, there's a bit of research around the topic. Larson and Hilden in 2016 surmised in their research that male victims differed from female victims in several ways. They were more often assaulted by a stranger, more likely to be assaulted by more than one perpetrator, more likely to be victim of drug-related sexual assault, and less likely to have experienced previous sexual abuse and less willing to report their assault to the police. Being a victim of sexual assault by another man is considered a taboo subject and it is likely that the dark figure of men exposed to sexual assault is much higher than is reported. And further to that, the Human Rights Campaign have stated for LGBTQ survivors of sexual assault, their identities and the discrimination that they face surrounding those identities often make them hesitant to seek help from police, hospitals, shelters or rape crisis centres, which are the very resources that are supposed to help them. Blaine, in 2010, said that in particular gender differences consistently emerge in the development of post-traumatic stress disorder in particular. The most common psychiatric diagnosis secondary to the violence and other traumatic events. There's a lot more work required in this. Almost all the research that I found on this subject is very clear that there are grey areas that mean that the amount of research done cannot really be generalised. Gervaid in 2018 said that it would be inappropriate to generalise from these findings and to argue that they represent views of all officers and professionals working in the voluntary sector. Nevertheless, we can see the emergence of particular and salient themes that do surface in the findings. And he echoes Blaine's report that the taboo around sexuality and gender identity precludes people from reporting these crimes. The paper also argues that the taboos and stigmas of homosexuality and male rape challenge and contradict the hegemonic masculinity. This also argues that prevailing and powerful discourses relating to hegemonic masculinity make male rape invisible, denying its existence and worth, and whilst maintaining a supporting heterosexuality, patriarchy and harmful gender expectations of men. His ultimate conclusion in that paper is that male rape is often actively forgotten. And he goes on to say that when he talks about hegemonic masculinity, he refers to the dominant ideal or model of masculinity in societies that, in contrast to subordinated masculinities that do not live up to the social ideal, in inverted commas, of masculinity. But again, he says that small studies, they cannot be generalised. We need to pay more attention to cultural, racial and gender specifics in order to get a better nuanced picture. Now, obviously, this podcast is particular to male rape. It's particular to the research that I've done has been particular to that. There are thousands, tens of thousands of papers about the effect of PTSD in sexual assault as a whole, and I'll be putting some of those in there as well on the website. I'm sure this is going to generate some discussion, and I certainly will be doing a lot more reading on this, because I barely even scratched the surface. This podcast was purely a vehicle to allow David to do what he needed to do and say this out loud and share his story with people, because he's absolutely determined to do so, and I'm incredibly grateful to David for contributing and speaking so openly to us. There are a number of websites which you can access with particular expertise in survival and overcoming trauma with regards to sexual assault. rsvporg.co.uk offers services, LGBT advocacy for people who've been the victim of sexual violence. Rapecrisis.org.uk, although primarily aimed at women and girls, do have specific information for men and boys who need that information. And of course, we talk about it in the interview, survivorsmanchester.org.uk. Duncan Craig, who I've had the pleasure of meeting in my capacity as a nurse in prison, he used to spend a lot of time in the prison talking to victims of sexual abuse, as it's often underpinning a variety of different conditions such as PTSD, and is very, very prevalent among the prison population. An incredible amount of work Duncan and his team do in the Survivors Manchester organisation, and I'd recommend looking at their website just to see how they operate. There's not really much more to say here, I don't think. I don't think it warrants any more of me rambling on. I think the interview has spoken for itself, but it only really remains for me to say thank you to David once again, and I hope this has been useful for you. So until next week, keep talking, and if you need to talk, you know where I am.